Well, we've reached the second Monday of the month. It's time for the Dirt Bag. Good morning. I'm Glenn Andreese, and across from me, Jim Gilbert.
Hi, Glenn. Welcome
back.
Nice Jim. To see you.
To my right, Weston Miller from OSU Extension Program. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
And to my left, Harriet Fassenfest, back for more. To talk about her new book, The Householder's Guide, or A Householder's Guide. I've been mispronouncing that all this time. A Householder's Guide to the Universe. And she'll be here to talk about that book and cooking and maybe storage, yes? Whatever.
Whatever you want.
Yeah. Of fall vegetables. And I can tell you about our dinner that we had last night that was chock full of said vegetables. So a full show today. And we're going to make it even fuller by opening up the phone lines. If you have questions for any of us, any and all of us, on anything, please give us a call. Kurt, what's the number? 231-8187? 503-231-8187. Jim will give us a report of maybe some events happening. Certainly there's one happening out at One Green World, the your second Saturday tastings. Yeah?
Yeah. It's a little short on the garden shows this time of year.
How about that?
But yeah, we'll have fruitcake and some other fruit things.
And speaking of fruitcake, do we have fruitcake here today?
We do have fruitcake here today.
Sampling and what else?
And persimmons, which I brought.
Yeah.
And it looks like Harriet brought something too.
Yeah, Harriet, what's...
Well, I brought something from the book, the applesauce cake that I use. I make applesauce. Well, I'm trying to talk about a system. So, but this year we made applesauce with quinces that my friend grew from a tree from your nursery.
How about that?
It must be really tasty.
It's so good.
Well, quince, maybe we could talk about that during the second half of the program. Because, boy, they are a wonderful cooking instrument. Nice color, nice aroma.
Fragrant. I mean, yeah, they're really wonderful fruit.
Yeah.
And they cook really well. Some, there are different varieties, as you well know.
All right.
Yeah.
These cook quickly.
And at, about halfway through, we'll have a new garden stumper. It's a tough one this time. People are going to have to go to Google, I'm sure, to figure this one out. I even asked our master gardener master, and he didn't know what it was.
So, wow.
It is a stumper.
And we'll have the answer to last week's garden stumper. Excuse me, last month. Do you remember that?
I don't.
Okay. It is, what apple is depicted on the Beatles' Apple Records?
Ooh.
What variety of apple? So I'll think about that one, too. So we'll have a new garden stumper. So, Weston, you're up first here. You've been with the Master Gardener program now for, what, 4 or 5 years?
Getting on 4 years.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And kind of brought a different focus, I might say, to the program?
Well, I don't know if it's different. The Master Gardener program is a educational program, and it's a service organization, and we are sponsored by Oregon State University Extension Service. The goal of the Master Gardener program is to train a cohort of volunteers to be able to go out into the community and serve as garden liaisons. In many ways, one of our major charges is to help to answer the general public's questions about growing and caring for plants. But we also recognize there's lots of interest in gardening, particularly vegetable and food gardening these days. And we're creating systems where people can take our trainings and then plug into valuable community gardening projects out in the broader community. The focus really these days is on sustainable gardening. And what that means is we want to encourage people to consider the least toxic options to manage their site, to really think about all aspects of sustainability, and to use their gardens as a vehicle to express sustainability in general.
And that's a good development. You know, I did my training in 1991. Oh, coming up on, this will be my 20th anniversary here. And I think that it come a long way from then. I know that, you know, even the even how it's taught is different now.
Well, you know, I've only been with the organization for 4 years, so
yeah.
I don't really
know
much
then.
About it before my time. But
yeah.
I do know that OSU is able to provide valuable information for the community. And my job is to help bring the research-based information from OSU and other land-grant universities to the general public and really to tailor it to what urban gardeners want. And these days it seems like folks really want to grow their food generally without using pesticides. And people are really concerned about food safety and sustainability and such. So our goal is to provide people with the information they need to make informed management decisions with the least toxic management options in mind.
That portion about the research-based, to me, rings true in that we're not relying on, you know, hearsay from your, you know, hairdresser's daughter's boyfriend's, you know, yard man.
Well, that's exactly right. So there's a lot of information available these days, particularly on the internet, and whether it's reliable information is one thing. What we encourage folks is that OSU provides research-based information. So we train our volunteers to be able to dig through OSU and other resources that are reliable, that have a scientific backing. And then folks are, our Master Gardener cohort are able to provide answers to the general public so that, again, they can make management informed management decisions.
And this training, we'll talk about the actual training now. It begins in next month?
Right. The Master Gardener training occurs January through March. It's one day per week in three different locations in the Portland metro area. On Tuesdays through that time frame, we'll be in Beaverton. On Thursdays, we'll be in Oregon City, and Fridays in Multnomah County in southeast Portland.
And this is the time to sign up? There's still room?
There's still room in all of our classes. The Portland class is filling up pretty quickly. Now's the time to sign up. We would encourage folks to go to metromastergardeners.org. It's our website where you can find all the information regarding signing up and schedules and things like that.
And there's a cost now for the materials and things like that. What's the cost? It's several hundred?
The cost of the program is $395.
$395.
And that really in many ways seems like a lot of money, but it covers the materials. It covers instruction for the program and also volunteer management. And still the program costs us over $800 per student to produce. So the rest of that's subsidized by OSU. So my time and my colleagues' time from OSU are subsidized by state money, essentially.
But it's very comprehensive training. I mean, you'll find out at the end that how much really you don't know. At least that was my experience.
That's absolutely true. So the Master Gardener training is the equivalent of an introduction to horticulture class at a college or university. It's fairly broad in scope, from soils to vegetable gardening to fruit tree pruning to integrated pest management. A good chunk of the time that we spend in the Master Gardener program is devoted to helping folks to learn how to diagnose pest problems and then also how to use resources in order to figure out what are the options in terms of management for a particular problem.
And there's flowers, too. I mean, we don't want to totally
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So
ignore that. Flowers.
We also look at lawn. Ornamental shrubs and lawn and just general horticulture, plant propagation, et cetera.
Yeah, so you really get a well-rounded look at it. That was my impression.
That's true, and I would say that we bring in a great core of instructors, either OSU professors, folks from local community colleges, experts in the field. So the quality of instruction, I would say, is quite high. And the format, really, because it happens in the winter, it's a lecture-based class. People always ask us for more hands-on opportunities. And what we tell them, well, that will come. And that comes through our volunteer internship. So the Master Gardener program is a 66-hour training that's in the class, and then it's coupled with a 66-hour volunteer internship in which we encourage folks to go out into the community, help to provide answers for the general public in terms of gardening, but also plugging into the many new school and community garden type projects that are springing up all over the metro area.
And there's just a plethora of opportunities. You know, you're not assigned to any one place. You can volunteer at where your interest is.
That's correct. We provide a slate of opportunities for folks, and they're able to pick and choose opportunities that work for their schedule and for their interests.
Now, back to the actual days. They're all day, one day a week, is that roughly?
That's correct. The class is 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. with an hour off for lunch. So it's a long day, chock full of information.
Right.
It seems like that limits the people to only those who have a day available. Evening classes aren't available.
That's absolutely right. So at this point, our in-person trainings are offered Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. OSU does offer an online Master Gardener program at this point, and they can find information about that at OSU eCampus. I believe that it's full for the Portland metro area at this juncture, but we get an awful lot of interest from people who don't have the flexibility in their schedule who want to take the online class. We're investigating options for 2012 about offering the class on Saturdays, where we could get folks who have regular 9-to-5 jobs or other commitments and aren't able to come to the format that we have available at this juncture.
It's my understanding that there used to be a class offered on Saturday, and one tying in now with the payback, so-called payback, and you take the 66 hours, and then do you pay back 66 hours? Is that, or what's the?
Well, that's correct. We term it as an internship.
Internship, okay.
So yeah, it's a 66-hour class coupled with a 66-hour volunteer internship, in which folks are able to act on their learning that they got in the classroom portion of the training.
What I remember hearing about the former Saturday classes is that was the least. It was hard for those people to pay back because they're working.
Well,
most of the time. But that's just what I heard. Maybe you could.
Yeah, so we provide opportunities for volunteering that are on weekdays. We have 3 telephone clinics across the metro area where folks can come and essentially help to answer people's questions via phone or via email. We also have about 20 clinics all over the metro area at farmers markets and other venues. Most of those occur on weekends. So people can come with their gardening questions. Ideally, they would bring a sample of a problem that they have on a particular plant, bring that to Master Gardeners, and they can at least start the research process and refer people to our offices if they can't answer the question on the spot.
It's kind of fun to diagnose what it is, especially if you don't know what it is. It just takes you deeper.
Well, that's absolutely true. I find the process of diagnosing plant problems a whole lot like detective work. So if people like the process of deductive reasoning and eliminating choices and really thinking like a scientist, then the Master Gardener program is a great way to really wrap your mind around the complexities of growing plants in our area.
We're speaking with Weston Miller, who's the coordinator as well as of the Master Gardener program, the metro area, as well as the, the horticulturist for this, or the extension agent, we used to call them. I don't know if you call yourselves that anymore.
Sure. I am an extension agent. My title is community and urban horticulturist. My job is to bring gardening information to the general public and the community garden scene here in the Portland metro area.
In one of the programs that you instituted since you've been here is the Organic Master Gardener program,
We didn't use that name.
Okay,
we call it the Organic Gardening Certificate Program.
Okay.
And that was a similar introduction type class, just providing folks with a broad base of information about growing and caring for plants. And we focused on organic management techniques.
So are there follow-up classes? I mean, so you get like a Master Gardener certificate if you do the 66 hours and then 66 hours out in the field or wherever, but is there follow-up? Can you, when you do that you can continue to go back and take refreshers? Because my experience is it'll take you a good long time doing this before you, I mean, you're like a mini master for a while before you can be. So are there opportunities for people to come back and take other aspects or actually go out and work on a farm or something where they get their hands in the dirt?
Right. Well, we do offer recertification classes, as we term them, which is ongoing education for Master Gardeners. Additionally, each year there's a Master Gardener mini college, which traditionally has taken place in Corvallis, and this year will be in Newport. That's ongoing education for Master Gardeners. And here in Portland and across the metro area, we have a lot of hands-on ways that people can plug in. We manage a demonstration garden in Southeast Portland at the Learning Gardens Lab, which is in conjunction with PSU and Portland Public Schools and the City of Portland. We have demonstration gardens in Washington County at the Fairplex, and as well in Oregon City on the Red Soils campus. Soon to be, we're establishing new garden plots there, and also at the end of the Oregon Trail Museum. We really do encourage folks to get out there and get their hands dirty. It's one thing to sit in a classroom and learn about gardening in a passive way, and it's quite another to get out in the field and get your hands dirty and to actually do the digging, the weeding, the planting, the watering, et cetera, that are part of maintaining and caring for gardens.
Why don't we take our first musical break now? And if you can go to the phone, if you have questions for Weston or any of us, 503-231-8187. And we'll be back and follow up a little bit on the Organic Gardener Certification Program. Well, of course, that's appropriate. That's Booker T and the MGs. That's called Homegrown. How about that? You wouldn't have known that, I know, but that's what it's called. Okay, so you're not going to be doing this organic gardener certification program this year, but you've got something to say about that anyway.
Well, yeah, so we did, we started and initiated the Organic Gardening Certificate Program. We did that in partnership with Oregon Tilth over the last 3 years. We've run the class four times. We've trained about 250 people. We've gotten lots of great feedback from folks on how to improve the program. Everyone always says more hands-on opportunities. So in 2011, we're going to shift gears a little bit and develop some new hands-on type trainings. And at this point, the plans are all preliminary, so I can't really share what they are. But we're hoping to have some great offerings and to return to the Organic Gardening Certificate Program in 2012.
And is that essentially the same timing, January through March? Or
no, the Organic Gardening Certificate Program, we've offered in the spring one time, and we've offered it in the fall three times. So I don't know the plan
okay.
at this point in time.
But it wouldn't be at the same time.
No, it's that? Definitely not during the winter, which is when the Master Gardener
busy
program
enough.
Takes place. It's a pretty big commitment of time.
Yeah, and then we get a snow day in there.
It throws everything off.
Yeah.
Snow days are tough.
Yeah. All right. No questions. That's good. I mean, that's fine. 503-231-8187. If you'd like to, if you have any vegetable questions, compost, soils, anything that Weston can help you with research-based. Mary has a question.
Well, yeah. I know from the food preservation program that they would have this hotline during the season that you could call up with questions about food preservation. So you have a similar, that's what you're saying a little bit about volunteers, that they man a phone line
staff.
Or staff.
Staff the phone, yeah. Not man,
yeah.
Staff.
Yeah. Oh, they staff the
phone. Yeah, here we go.
Oh, they staff the phone.
Yeah.
So is that true? I mean, do you have that or how does that work in terms of if someone's out in their garden and they just have a question, can they call? Is there?
Right. So it's a public service of Oregon State University to help answer the public's questions. And the Master Gardener Program in many ways was designed to help do that, to help people who are extension agents overwhelmed with the volume of calls from the general public. We established the Master Gardener Program as a vehicle to train volunteers to help in that regard. We've got three telephone lines here in the Portland area. And we encourage people to bring plant samples in. It's really easiest to diagnose plant problems by having an actual sample. We've got a clinic in Montgomery Park in Northwest Portland. That's in conjunction with West Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District. We have an extension office out in Beaverton in the Capitol Center, and we also have an office in Oregon City. There are three separate telephone lines associated with those clinics, and people can find information at metromastergardeners.org, where we have posted clearly the telephone numbers and the email addresses and such so that people can get a hold of us with their gardening questions.
And that happens throughout? I mean, is it a particular time? Like, I know the food preserver master line is a particular few months in the season. So
we go all year. We've got volunteers standing by right now waiting for your call.
<Woo-hoo>!
So please give us a ring. We're
yes.
happy to help.
Now, could someone clean my garden up? If I can call them, you know, the others.
Well, we can't really perform site visits and we can't really perform labor. What we do is provide information services for folks.
And something I've been thinking about a lot, Weston, is as you probably know, a lot of the research on fruit has been done in climates that aren't ours. And I think that they're placed in Southeast, that Lesher Farm?
It's the Learning Gardens Lab. It's the former Green Thumb site, Southeast 60th and Duke.
Oh, right. Okay. Great. Do you have any plantings there that you can observe and see which ones, like which varieties are better suited to our climate and not? Is that?
We don't have any formal trials there. We definitely do in Corvallis at OSU. We have researchers who are looking at disease susceptibility and such for a wide variety of fruits and nuts and vegetables and so on. So the beauty of my job is that I have access to the information that these folks are generating out of OSU and other land-grant universities, and then I interpret it and make that information available for the general public.
So what is the focus of your work at the Green Thumb site?
The focus of our work at the Green Thumb site is really on educational gardening. We have a number of PSU graduate students through the Graduate School of Education, Leadership, and Sustainable Education Program. These folks work with students from Lane Middle School. They come across the street and spend a good amount of time out in the garden. We also work with Portland Public Schools on site with a community transitions program. We have a mini cut flower venture where we grew and sell cut flowers and distribute them out to the community. So it's a job skill and life skills training program mm-hmm. for Portland Public Schools. Mm-hmm. I work a lot with my volunteers out there at the site. The master gardeners have a demonstration site in their own line of educational programming. Metro has a demonstration site located at 58th and Cooper, which is open to the general public and has lots of great signage where people can go check it out. So there's lots of different things going on the site. Additionally, Portland Parks and Recreation has two community gardens there on site. So really, in many ways, it's a horticulture magnet, and we're using the site as a way to get people outside, to get them thinking about gardening, and to get their hands dirty so they can actually learn the skills associated with gardening, too.
Sounds like a busy 3 acres.
Well, the whole site is 11 acres, and the part that I'm directly responsible for is about 3 acres. And again, it's in conjunction with a whole lot of partners.
Great.
Okay, Kurt. Okay, Jim, you're up first.
Yeah. Am I on the air?
Yep, you're ready to roll.
Good. I want to ask how best to improve clay soil using coffee grounds. Do I put it in through the compost pile or to use it for top dressing?
How many coffee grounds do you have?
I get them from Starbucks.
Okay, so you've got...
And I think I probably get about 20 pounds a week.
Okay, so the question is how to improve clay soils with coffee grounds. And the answer is it can be utilized in a number of ways, and all those ways that you mentioned I think are valid. So number one, composting coffee grounds is a great way to further break it down so that the nutrients in the organic matter would be more available to soil microorganisms and thereby help to improve the structure and also provide some nutrients for the plants. As a top dressing, coffee grounds also works quite well.
How thick would you recommend?
How thick would I recommend? Well, it depends on the crop that you're trying to grow, but at this time of year, if you're just laying the garden to bed for a period of time, a couple inches, and then maybe covered with some coffee sacks or something like that to help further prevent erosion.
And cats from digging it
And cats from digging it up as well. Yeah, absolutely. So coffee grounds, I think, are a great addition to soil. Certainly, if you compost it first, it'll mellow a little bit and I think probably help the soil structure quite a bit.
Okay.
And then just lastly, I think it would be important to also try to dig the material in. So with organic matter, it's handy if we can use a digging fork or another tool to try to incorporate it as deeply as possible into the soil, and thereby mixing it up and increasing the surface area of the interaction between all the different particles. And over time, it's possible to improve the soil substantially.
Yeah, wouldn't happen overnight.
No, it doesn't happen overnight.
Nothing will for clay, but...
And that's one of the things about gardening is that it's a long-term process in which we learn how to communicate with plants, and that's really one of the most fun parts about it for me is that it's a... an ongoing, lifelong learning process.
We're not into instant gratification.
Right.
Well, we will be when we sample this fruit and fruit cakes and cake that's coming.
That's right.
Yes.
I just wanted to mention also that sometimes a lot of people talk to me about clay soil, and they always have this downcast look, and you know, they're like, oh my God, my soil is, I have this clay soil. Yeah. And I try to counsel them and say, well, you know, that's not really so bad. It's, I mean, clay soil
could be worse.
Yeah. I mean, it holds a lot of nutrients and holds moisture. And if you treat it right, and of course, the constant improvement of adding more organic matter to it, it's actually a good soil, unless it's in a swamp or something.
It's a good point. Clay soils do hold water and they do hold nutrients. And in many ways, I'd rather have clay soil mm-hmm. than sandy soil.
Yeah.
The trick is just to figure out how to improve the drainage. And we can do that by adding organic matter over time. And we can do that also by just going up and installing raised beds and bringing the roots up out of the mucky clay soil. And for things like raspberries and blueberries that really depend on good drainage, that's one of the recommendations that we have.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I have a newbie question. So you're doing compost, and at some point it's broken down, and it's like soil. Is there like a time that you should use that? I mean, like, is it sort of live and sort of really, you know, healthy in terms of having, you know, inoculants? You know, is it healthy things for the soil? You know, or does it matter when? You know, because I have some that's on the bottom there, and I just kind of throw it into the new compost and just. I don't know what I'm doing. I just do.
Right. So people have a lot of different methods of composting. It sounds like you have what's called a cold pile where you just throw stuff on top and let it break down over time.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, the stuff towards the bottom will be in small enough pieces that it'll be usable. And what I would recommend is getting your shovel and scooping out that material and passing it through maybe a quarter acre grate with your hands over a wheelbarrow. And at that point in time, it's ready to go into the garden, and then you can dig it in and incorporate it in. In terms of sort of the timing of using it, the longer it sits around, probably the more likely that nutrients would leach out of it. But the organic matter that's part of the compost will still be there. And that's really what improves the soil most with compost is the organic matter, because it helps to, as that material is broken down by all the bacteria and fungi that are in the soil, they excrete a form of glue that causes the soil particles to stick together. When that happens, there's more space for air and water in the soil, and it makes it so that the plants grow better. So, and in terms of introducing life and all the biotic factor of compost, I'd say most of it's still going to be there. It might be dormant for a period of time, but when it goes back into the soil, life works itself out, and the organisms that need to be there will be, and they're probably already present in your soil anyway.
All right. No, let's go to the, let's take our, it's time for the garden stumper. So we know what that means. I caught Kurt off. There we go. Okay, see if you know this. A very simple one here. The question is, what is Jory? J-O-R-Y. J-O-R-Y. What is Jory? So if you know the answer to that, 503-231-8187. Well, also, maybe we should just give the answer to the Apple Records Apple. Oh, Esteban called it in, and he had the right answer. What was it? It's a Granny Smith. Granny Smith apple is pictured there on the cut, or on side A. Is it the cut side? On side B, it's the uncut side. All right. And you know what happened? You know what happened to go 30 years ago today?
Glenn, can you provide a clue about this week's or this month's stumper, Jory?
Yes.
It's kind of obscure.
Yes, I can. It has to do with what we've been talking about.
That's right. It's certainly appropriate to our previous discussion.
We've mentioned it several times. It is also, it has a special state designation. Okay.
Ooh.
We'll go with that. Okay, so is our caller still there? Pardon?
Yes, I am.
FUF. Okay, well, you're on the air. Buff.
Hi. I suppose I'm following up with a previous caller, but I think I am going to probably have to remove some of the layer of my topsoil, which is 98% clay because of flooding. It's flooding into my basement, my neighbor's yard.
Mm.
It killed two of the apple trees that I've planted over the last 2 years. I've added a lot of organic matter to the topsoil, worked it in, but frankly, 12 inches down, 18 inches down, which is what you have with a slightly young tree, it's not really making much of a dent. So I have sort of two issues, both with having to, I think at this point, remove the soil and what to add in addition to continuing to do compost and other organic material. Because the flooding...
Yeah, well, that's the main issue there, it seems.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just too much water coming in there.
Yeah. And it's an El Nino winter again, and my neighbors are flooding, and...
Where do you live?
Inner southeast Portland.
Uh-huh. What's flooding?
The basement is flooding. And
I mean, it's just runoff. I mean, it's not like Johnson Creek rising.
Yeah, and I put in a drainage system, and I've done this, and I've done that. And I talked to a soils person from East Multnomah County, and they said, you know, 3 feet down, you're solid clay, and it never dries out, and you might consider removing some of the topsoil and even putting gravel in, digging up your garden to get better drainage. And I've been trying to be organic, and it's just been a challenge.
Weston, what do you have to say?
Sure. I would really think about diverting surface runoff away from the site as best as possible. So that's installing drain tile, that's having swales or other devices to get water out of there. So you definitely don't want to have any standing water.
Oh, yeah. I just put in a French drain,
right,
too.
And what I would do in your case is I wouldn't remove any soil. That's a lot of work, and it's going to end up costing you a lot of money. My suggestion would be to build raised beds, so get some sort of border. Cedar wood works great. Juniper works great. Plastic wood works great. Treated lumber also is considered safe by the EPA. And then purchase a 3- or 4-way soil mix from your local landscape supply company and then plant into that. And you shouldn't, if you go up 12 inches or 18 inches with your beds, then you shouldn't have any drainage problems.
Put some new trees into that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah,
well,
absolutely. So stuff that's planted in the ground, if you have that heavy-duty soil, clay, and surface drainage coming onto the site, I don't have high hopes for being able to grow in the ground, but raised beds should work really
well
for you.
That's certainly been my experience. My second question, very briefly, is, I bought a tumbler composter, and when it was warm in September, some sort of larvae from a maple leaf got in, and there are, like a Stephen King nightmare, thousands.
Soldier fly larvae, and they actually are just helping to break down all of the organic matter that's there. Soldier flies aren't a nuisance. They're not a pest.
No,
really.
They're not filter flies. They're like they're about 2 inches to an inch and a half long with little striations on their back. They're like a flat, beetle-y thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Soldier flies.
That's it. Soldier fly larvae.
Oh.
The adult looks kind of like a, and you very, not rarely, but you have to look for them sometimes. The adult looks somewhat wasp-like, but it's black, longish. Doesn't fly very fast.
No, they're not flying. They've got little striations on their back, and they inchworm along.
This is the adult.
That's the larva. So the bottom line with soldier fly larva is that it does look a little bit freaky. Your whole pile will be squirming and writhing, then they just help to break stuff down, and then the adults will fly, and they're not a nuisance. So with soldier flies, I wouldn't worry about them.
No.
Okay.
Right.
10,000?
Oh, yeah. Easily.
Okay.
The more organic matter you have, that's what they're feeding on. So we usually see it in the fall where you got lots of windfall fruit in there or lots of stuff coming from the kitchen or even grass. If it's high nitrogen, they're doing it.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, our calls are stacking up, but we want to get to Harriet first. Mike, can you make this quick?
Yes, I can.
All right, you're on then.
Harriet.
What was that? Oh, Harriet.
Harriet, Mike Miller.
Hey, Mike Miller. Hey, yeah. Mike.
Oh, wait a minute. This isn't a dating service here.
Congratulations on your book. Hey, I have a quick question. I know you're in the canning scene. When I was young, living in Eastern Oregon, we had a custom cannery where people would simply prepare food, cut up, and take it to the cannery, and they would put it in cans for you. Is there anything like that going on in the metropolitan area?
No, I haven't heard of anything like that. When I was in Georgia, I went to the university, in Athens, and I remember them saying that they were going to try to resurrect something like that there. And they were very popular, as were, like, the meat lockers, when people were really using those skills to, you know, to create their stores and fill their pantries. So I know that there are a lot of people that are working on, you know, community canning kitchens, or they're beginning to, but not a facility where you can just, as far as I know, where you could just bring your produce to a mm-hmm. facility and have it processed, which seems like a real market opportunity, as they say.
Yeah, yes.
An entrepreneurial, because it seems like that would be a great idea. But I do remember you mentioning that once to me. Yeah, no, I don't know of anything here. You getting too tired to do your own, Mike?
No. I have great help.
I know you do.
All right.
Another quick question on composting. I've heard that orange peel is kind of detrimental to some life forms in the soil.
What was that? What was that again? I'm sorry, repeat yourself.
Orange peel.
Oh, okay.
If they're, you know, the citronella in that, is that harmful to some organisms in the soil profile?
Depends how many you put in, but...
Yeah, orange peels don't break down really quickly, so generally it's not recommended that you put them in worm boxes. Worms don't really like them a whole lot.
Uh-huh.
In a outside composting bin, a small amount of citrus peels will go in there fine. If you can cut them up and make them into small pieces, it'll break down faster. But I haven't heard of anything in regards to the citrus oils affecting the process.
So it would, if I use the term loosely, it would not be toxic to most.
No, absolutely not. You'd just be looking at them for a while.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
Say hi to Jill.
I will, Harriet. Good luck with your book.
Thanks.
Okay, and we'll come. Thanks for that intro, Mike. We'll come back and talk to Harriet about her book after this music break here. Oh boy, did we. We're still in the process of enjoying some of this home cooking from a lot of locally grown fruits, produce, or fruits, nuts. Well, maybe not vegetables, but let me tell you what I had for last night. I had a parsnip and beet salad grated that was in pineapple juice, a little vinegar and oil from the garden, and squash. I cooked up a sweet mama, one of my favorite winter squashes. And we had some veggie sloppy joes that were made also with some home onions and peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah. That's why we're bringing Harriet in here to tell you what more about her book, A Householder's Guide to the Universe. Just tell us about the book, first of all, Harriet Fossenfest.
Let's see. The book is really sort of a little bit what I say. Well, I say a lot of different things. But, you know, in some ways, it's home economics with a larger net. You know, it's about the sowing, growing, and stowing of food, kind of, in a way, what that system is, how to think about it. Like, if you're, you know, I mean, everybody's very into and clear about growing food. A lot of people want to do it, but it's, as they say, an inconvenient truth that you will be spending a lot of time in the kitchen, too, if you intend to use what you grow. And how to make that work, and how to plan your garden a little bit with the idea that you're going to be eating these things, you know, mm-hmm. throughout the year, how to make that work. I mean, the book is not just focusing on growing food. There's also, you know, supplementing it, sourcing and working directly with the farmers, getting your meat from a farmer, getting your eggs, your dairy. So in some ways, it's creating your stores versus shopping at their stores. So that's, and then the perspective is a little bit about, I mean, the why of it. I mean, it's, as I say, I'm a city girl. I was born and raised in the Bronx, and so it wasn't immediately obvious that I would do this. I didn't grow up in a farm. So for me, it was a response to what I saw was a global economic system that was kind of running amok. You know, the production, distribution, and consumption of goods. You know, it was huge. It was, you know, huge loop, far-reaching, crazy in a way. And, you know, in many ways. So this was my response, you know, the smallest loop possible. Sowing, growing, and stowing, or, you know, production, distribution, and consumption. Smallest loop possible,
mm-hmm.
and not... and not, you know, getting things in boxes and all the embodied energy and all the conversations we were having about all these different things about what would a healthy economy look like. So the book is, you know, part political, part social commentary, you know, how did we get here, you know, these past 50 years and moving from, you know, most significantly from, you know, any kind of rural background to a fully immersed, you know, urban environment and culture. It's part food preservation guide, part gardening guide, not to supplant all the other good information, but it is there. So, I mean, I write it in some parts because I am a novice and because I know that we learn slowly. And so I felt like that in many ways was my audience, because there's a lot of people that are attempting to live this way. And part of it is a memoir. You know, it's a year in the life of a householder.
Is it divided by months?
It's divided by months, mm-hmm. and it's kind of what I'm doing in the home, what I'm doing in the kitchen, and what I'm doing in the garden, and how they would theoretically all interrelate. So that's why, you know, the applesauce cake that I brought that has quinces in it, I mean, that's a good example. I have something called, you know, the food preservation game plan, and that is a way to really think through what, in fact, you want to put your time to during the, you know, food preservation year, you know, so you don't necessarily run out and do, you know, 40 quarts of peaches if no one really particularly likes peaches. You know, it's a little bit to think through it. And so applesauce for me, you know, I bake with it throughout the year. I serve it, but it's a, you know, power player. And it's taken me some time to figure this out. What works in my kitchen? What are the things that I will put my attention to? Because it can, you know, it can get crazy. It can be overwhelming if you're trying to grow your food or source your food from farmers. And so I brought this in because this is the good work.
So these are quince that you got from a friend that came from Jim's farm at some point.
Yeah, well, the...
You know what variety that might be, Jim?
I'm thinking it was like Russian. Am I thinking it was Russian? I mean, because they were so beautiful, yellow and fragrant, and recipes I had seen for cooking them that, you know, these cooked in a snap, and I've been able to just cut them up and put them in with my applesauce. These were Jonagold apples that I got from an organic and biodynamic farm out in Hood River, and some of the quince that I got from Sandra, who has Buffalo Gardens and sells here.
Right. Well, the Russian varieties like Aromatnaya, Kuganskaya, Krimskaya, those are all have this much, much sweeter quince than the old style ones. Really easy to cook and prepare.
And how about easy to grow?
Yeah.
Hardy?
Hardy.
Oh, absolutely.
Hers are just...
How about that?
And big fruit. I mean, they're just really quite spectacular.
Oh, they are, and they smell so good. You know, you just put them in a bowl and, you know, just...
Yeah.
Oh, they're so fragrant. So I make quince liqueur. And so, yeah, speaking of fruit cake, there's a recipe in here for my fruit cake, but you've brought this beautiful... And we're here to try to, I think, bring the ashes of the much maligned fruitcake. We're here as advocates.
Absolutely. So Jim has a fruitcake here that's just chock full. There might be a little flour in there, but...
just enough to hold it together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's in it?
Oh, there's figs, prunes, some slivered almonds from our own almonds that we grew.
Oh.
Mm.
Yeah. Walnuts from Newburgh, hazelnuts from our area, some dried persimmons.
Oh, and I should mention, too, we have fresh persimmon here that Jim brought in a tastefully prepared tray of
We're sort of getting persimmon. Toward the end of the ripe fruit, but persimmon, we harvested this just before that hard freeze hit. That sort of wiped out the remaining ones on the trees. But we went out the day before, actually, and harvested a whole bunch of them, and they're just now turning a little soft, and they're great.
Before the freeze, I harvested all my carrots, too. Still munching on those.
I left one bed. I didn't experiment. I pulled most of them up, but one I left in and covered up with some.
Yeah, if it was mulch, I'll bet you that it'll be.
Even on mulch, my carrots on the ground are doing just fine. Still.
I didn't know what kind of cold we were going to get. Yeah. You know, the 12, 13, and 14, like we did last year at this time, the ground froze solid, and so did the, because it was so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That cold, and the carrots just turned to mush that were left there.
Well, this is my question. My theory was I pulled them up when they were mush anyway, but that's because made believe they were frozen vegetables, and I cooked them like that. I just started throwing them into soups and things. I mean, you know, my mother always says that hunger makes the best cook, so I guess I was pretty darn hungry. So this cloth, I just, you know, this is the cheesecloth, the cloth that goes around it, you know, when you steep it.
Around the fruitcake. Yeah,
around the fruitcake, to steep it. So what did you, because I'm going to suck on this thing.
So I made an extremely infrequent visit to the local liquor store. And bought a pint of brandy for $6 and some cheesecake, and then you dip
cheesecloth.
Cheesecloth, and you dip the cheesecloth in the brandy and wrap the fruitcake in it.
Yeah, and that in actuality, I mean, it's it is a food preservation tool. So we preserve it with the liquor, and that would last if we could control ourselves. I mean, that would be fine years from now.
So why is it that fruitcake has this wrap?
I think it's bad fruitcake.
Yeah.
I think it's
maybe not homegrown.
Sorry, OSU, the maraschino cherries, I think had a lot to do with it. And that somehow brings us to the question of what are we developing and why? But having said that, maraschino cherries are some of the problems with that. I know it's we have to use those cherries. And also those green things that are the green things.
The commercial fruit mix, or is that what it's called?
Yeah,
fruit mix,
that puts an off flavor to it. And
I happen to like it, but
I'm
hungry all the time. So.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But,
And, of course, the ingredients, the cheaper ingredients are used mostly. Yeah, and so things like nuts, which are more expensive, are less frequent in the commercial fruitcakes. It's really hard. The fruitcake made with dried fruit and real nuts and lots of both.
Yeah.
We use butter also as the oil. It just makes it just a whole different world. It's nothing like the fruitcake you buy in the store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's too bad everybody can't come and taste here.
Come out to the nursery.
Yeah, I guess next Saturday. That's your thing. Wes and I wanted to get your take on the carrots there. It seemed like you had something to say more about storage carrots.
Well, no, I had a question for Harriet. Is it safe to describe your book as Martha Stewart for the environmentally and socially conscious locavore?
Well, someone said it was a cross between Martha Stewart and Che Guevara, and so that may be appropriate as well. I thought it was Julia Child and Courtney Love, but it doesn't really, somewhere in there. And of course, I don't remember what you just asked me. I think it is about, among other things, it is about returning to the home in part with this idea that if we are going to grow this food, that we need to also process it and put it on our tables and serve our meals, and not just on the occasion and not just as it relates to sort of food in vogue or fancy cooking, but as a lifestyle. And if you're really serious about, supporting farmers, not just on the occasional, I'm going to get a couple of tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes to serve for myself, but in quantities that I think farmers would appreciate in bushels and pecks, whatever they are anymore, and use your bottles year in and year out, and try to sort of, it is another way to approach stewardship, and I think in a very positive way. So it's a key and a story about how to do that, with lots of good information and some funny personal stories, because Courtney can be crazy.
Martha Stewardship, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And where can one get this book?
Oh, yeah. So you can get it at Powell's. You can get it at Pistol's Nursery. You can get it at Annie Bloom's, at Broadway Books, pretty much all over town.
Great.
So, and I hope you do.
Yeah, I'd like to get a coffee.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, it's my turn to thank Harriet for being here. Thank you very much. Harriet Fossenfest with her book,
A
Householder's Guide to the Universe, A Calendar of Basics from the Home and Beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Start in your home and then keep on going.
And thanks for bringing in the applesauce/quince cake. I'll finish that up here off the air. Weston Miller, the OSU Extension agent, urban horticulturist. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And the website for getting more information on the Master Gardener program or for signing up?
www.metromastergardeners.org.
Master Gardeners?
Gardeners,
plural.
Plural.
Okay. And Jim, onegreenworld.com, eh?
That's right. Yeah. It's great.
He'll be here. You'll be there next Saturday. What time's?
It's 10 to 4:30.
For fruit tasting, cake fruit tasting.
Fruit cake, fruit cakes, fruits, and plants.
Persimmons and everything else. So. Yeah. All right. Well, the solstice is upon us, or very shortly. It's a little warmer now. Kind of got to like that. So.
Yeah, I know.
Kurt, thank you very much, our ace engineer. And we'll be back next month. Be well.